supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Good evening, I'm Dave Heller, WHYY News. The Republican tax overhaul is giving nonprofits in our region some holiday heartburn. This is NewsWorks Tonight. As WHYY's Aaron Mozell reports, organizations are concerned they'll see a dip in charitable donations when certain provisions take effect Monday.
Right now, you get to write off gifts to charity if you itemize them. But the GOP tax bill doubles the standard deduction. That's designed to provide a tax cut to most people, at least initially. But it also means fewer people will itemize their deductions. And that's a big deal to nonprofits.
It might be a disincentive for giving.
Janine Lisitsky heads up Women Against Abuse, which provides emergency shelter and mental health services to victims of domestic violence in Philadelphia. She says fewer donations could mean less money for counseling and other interventions meant to help women break free from the trauma of domestic abuse.
We're not going to be able to interrupt it and change the pathway that people are on in terms of health and well-being and safety, and it perpetuates cycles, generations of violence.
So the organization is urging donors to give now while the old tax law still applies. The anti-violence group Ceasefire PA has noticed a bump in donations during the holiday season compared to last year. As for next year, Executive Director Shira Goodman says the nonprofit is relying on donors' goodwill.
I'm hopeful that people will continue to give, and maybe they're going to take a little, they're giving a little extra now because they can get that extra deduction now, but I'm hopeful that the people who find our work meaningful will still support it.
How much the new tax law will impact nonprofits may depend on what kind of work they do, says Pedro Ramos, who heads the Philadelphia Foundation. He says organizations like Women Against Abuse may have the toughest time because they rely the most on private donations and on limited public funds.
A lot of the organizations that provide needed services to the most vulnerable are already financially fragile. So in this season of giving, it's important to make sure that we continue our support for them and that we call attention to the work that they do.
So don't be surprised if you start seeing more emails from your favorite nonprofits asking for a donation. Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
This disclosure, the Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. As courts across the country consider cases charging partisan political gerrymandering, the National Constitution Center recently brought together prominent experts and participants in those legal battles to talk about the political and constitutional issues. WHYY's Dave Davies was there.
The battle that's captured the most national attention is Wisconsin. A federal court struck down boundaries drawn by the state legislature as biased in favor of Republicans, and the U.S. Supreme Court has heard arguments on the appeal. Courts have long acknowledged that gerrymandering exists, but have lacked a reliable standard for measuring just how much of a political edge a given legislative map gives to one party. In the Wisconsin case, a new mathematical formula made a difference. It considers election results and measures how efficient each party is with its votes while running in the boundaries at issue. If Democrats are packed into a few districts that they win by big margins, while Republicans are strategically spread to capture many districts by narrower spreads, the resulting efficiency gap measures the bias of the political boundaries. At least that's the idea. One of the panelists at the Constitution Center was Nicholas Stephanopoulos, a University of Chicago law professor who helped develop the efficiency gap.
Wisconsin's map in 2012, 2014, and 2016 had one of the very largest and most pro-Republican efficiency gaps of the last half century. It's not quite the worst map over the last 50 years, but it's something like one of the worst four or five over five separate redistricting cycles. And this is confirmed by multiple other measures of partisan gerrymandering. So we know with a high degree of confidence that the Republican advantage in Wisconsin is virtually unprecedented in its size and also now in its consistency. You know, three straight elections of double-digit pro-Republican efficiency gaps.
On the other side was attorney Aaron Murphy, who defended the Wisconsin map before the Supreme Court.
I think that there's a problem with the idea of equating every vote for a particular candidate as a vote for that political party writ large. Because it's just not the case that every time you vote for, you know, the Republican in your district, that means you want every Republican who's running in every district throughout the state to win. I mean, I think this last election is a pretty good example of the reality that people still can and do split their tickets among political parties, and votes are driven by a lot more than just what party is next to the name of the candidate. At a more kind of pragmatic level, I think one of the big problems with the efficiency gap theory and is that it is inherently kind of politically biased on account of political geography as it exists right now. I mean, if you think about it, I think it's probably true across a great many states in this country that it's just the reality is that Democratic voters are concentrated in large cities where candidates win by an overwhelmingly Democratic vote. And Republican voters tend to be spread out in broader geographic areas where they win comfortable margins in a lot of them, but nowhere near the majorities that you tend to see in high population cities. And so it is just the nature of that geography of the typical state, Wisconsin included, that there are going to be more wasted votes for Democrats than for Republicans.
Stephanopoulos responded.
With respect to Aaron's first point that, you know, all of these different metrics are simplifying politics by assuming that party is all there is, that would have been a great point in 1975 or 1980, when split ticket voting was rampant, when you had lots of liberal Northeastern Republicans, lots of conservative Southern Democrats. For better or worse, though, we're in a different era today. Levels of split-ticket voting are infinitesimal. Partisanship now is an unbelievably dominant driver of voter behavior at different electoral levels and over time. On the political geography point, I would say that this is a complicated topic where the impact of spatial patterns on any of these metrics is going to vary a lot from one state to another. But a couple of important data points. In Wisconsin, we know what would happen from a recent article if one was to draw hundreds of district maps for the state legislature without considering electoral data at all. Now, if there was a real natural pro-Republican tilt to Wisconsin's geography, we would expect those hundreds of randomly drawn maps to lean consistently in a Republican direction. But they don't. They are, on average, very, very close to perfectly neutral in their treatment of the parties. So, you know, this is the best technique we have for measuring the impact of a given state's political geography. And we know that in Wisconsin, there are enough super red suburban districts to offset the deep blue districts in Madison or Milwaukee. We know, you know, with virtual certainty that the observed map is not the result of political geography because we never, ever see a simulated map that comes anywhere close to the pro-Republican bias of the actual map.
Nick Stephanopoulos and Aaron Murphy at the National Constitution Center recorded December 11th. You can find a link to the entire discussion on the center's website or at whyy.org. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
During this last week of the calendar year, we've been reflecting on some of our region's biggest stories of 2017 and what may lie ahead for the coming year. In the field of education, the Philadelphia School District rolled out its pre-K effort and community schools initiative, two major campaign promises of Mayor Jim Kenney. Though funding is dependent upon another hallmark of the Kenney administration, the city's sweetened beverage tax, which was the target of a lawsuit from the soda industry. Here to provide a review is WHYY's Bobby Allen. And Bobby, are the city's legal troubles with the tax finally over?
The short answer, Dave, is not quite. A few months after city council passed the soda tax last year, a group of lawyers backed by the soda industry tried to stop it from taking effect. The biggest argument was that it's basically a double sales tax and that's illegal. So far, though, two courts in Pennsylvania have disagreed and delivered the city huge victories. And now we're all waiting to hear from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court as to whether they are going to take up the lawsuit. If they agree to, that could put the future of the tax in jeopardy. If they decide not to take it up, then the lower court ruling will stand and Mayor Jim Kenney will be very happy.
Why has the tax survived legal challenges to date?
So it has everything to do with how the tax was structured. So the tax is not on consumers at the point of sale, but on distributors who sell and transport drinks to stores. Now, skeptics of the tax say, well, those stores are just passing it off to consumers, so it's basically an unconstitutional double tax. But how it is technically structured is a big distinction in the eyes of the law. A trial court and an appeals court both said that the city has the legal right to pass the tax. Now, one of the appeals judges did issue a minority opinion this past summer saying, look, the tax is triggered only when there is a transaction at cash registers. So even though it's technically not a sales tax, it sure as heck operates like one. And we'll know soon whether that legal argument gains traction with the state's high court.
Bobby, Chicago lawmakers repealed a similar soda tax just 2 months after it was passed, and that also faced a similar legal challenge from retailers. Will that have any bearing on the future of Philly's tax on sweetened drinks?
The tax in Chicago is just wholly different than the one in Philadelphia. First, it is a point of sales tax, not a distributor tax like Philadelphia's. And the Chicago tax was passed to help plug a growing budget deficit. Many saw it as just a money grab. And this is unlike Philadelphia's tax, which is being used to support expanded pre-kindergarten and improvements to rec centers, libraries, and parks. And remember, Chicago's soda tax didn't go away as a direct result of a lawsuit. Elected officials there voted to undo it. But that, of course, came after the soda industry spent big bucks attempting to sway public opinion.
Bobby, who else is going to be watching the Pennsylvania Supreme Court decision?
Well, three cities in California have passed soda taxes recently. There's a soda tax in Boulder, Colorado, and starting on the 1st of January, a soda tax that looks very similar to Philadelphia's will start in Seattle. So you can bet that if any of the soda industry's legal arguments gain purchase with the Pennsylvania High Court, those same lines of attacks will be copied and potentially used as ammo by opponents of soda taxes in those other places. And former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg will also be watching. Remember his failed effort to fight obesity in New York when he tried to ban big soda drinks there. Well, after that didn't work out for him, he has been pouring tens of millions of dollars around the country, including here in Philadelphia, to pass taxes on soda as sort of a public health measure. And of course, in the mayor's office, Jim Kenney will certainly be watching this carefully and hoping that the legal battle is over soon. The full expansion of pre-K in this city is on hold, and so is the big rebuild of city parks until the tax is on firm legal footing. Because without the tax, Dave, there's not going to be any money to pay for these programs.
Thanks, Bobby.
Thanks.
WHYY's Bobby Allen. And now for a look at where that soda tax money is going. Let's speak next with education reporter Avi Wolfman-Aaron. Avi, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Avi, with the lawsuit pending, where do the mayor's signature education initiative stand?
So at this point, there were supposed to be 3,000 pre-K seats funded by the sweetened beverage tax. At this point, there are only 2,000. They're expanding less quickly than originally planned because of the lawsuit. They're keeping some of that in reserve. It costs about $8,500 a child, so adding 1,000 new seats is a major investment. They also are funding 11 community schools with the beverage tax money. There were 9 named in the first year, and they're supposed to get to 25 eventually. Right now, things are mostly at a standstill, and there are about 400 kids on pre-K waiting lists around the city.
Who's benefiting from the pre-K program?
One of the things about Philly's pre-K expansion that makes it different from other government-subsidized pre-K programs in the city is that there was no income cap. So anyone is technically eligible for the city's pre-K program, and people were worried that families who didn't really need the help would take advantage of it. So far, that's mostly not turned out to be true. The families who've taken advantage of the city pre-K program have mostly been poorer than the city average, lower income families. About 40% live below the poverty line. And then there's other ancillary benefits. There's been some hiring associated with the expansion of city pre-K. The city says about 250 new hires. So there's some economic benefit there. And there's also been some programs who, with the money that they've received through the city government, have been able to improve their quality rating in the eyes of the state. So there's a few benefits in addition to just the expansion of seats.
But given the earlier context that funding is limited, it does seem odd that there are no income restrictions. Was that a legal matter to not cap it?
No, I think it was essentially done for integrative purposes. They didn't want to have all the programs be sort of socioeconomically isolated. And I think, frankly, they also wanted there to be some constituency who felt invested in this, who was not just lower-income families.
Of course, Mayor Kenney's plans for education ultimately extend far beyond pre-K.
Yeah, it's interesting. When Mayor Kenney came into office, pre-K, and to a lesser extent, community schools were his big upfront signature education initiatives. This year, though, the School Reform Commission, the state-controlled panel that ran the Philadelphia schools for 16 years, voted itself out of existence. And Mayor Kenney will basically become the most important political figure for the K-12 system here in the city, traditional public schools and charter schools as well. So it'll be interesting to see where pre-K fits into that. It was his banner issue, but now he's got the responsibility and counsel to a lesser extent of the entire K-12 system.
Thanks, Avi.
Thanks, Dave.
WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt on NewsWorks Tonight. For the Syrian refugees who arrived before the U.S. stopped accepting them this year, living here means facing a series of hurdles and firsts, from learning a new language to driving in the snow for the first time. WHYY's Laura Benchoff checks in with Mustafa Amal and their two young children who came from Syria to Bucks County last month. Make that November 2016. They asked to use only their first names because they still have family in danger in Syria. Here's Laura.
Mustafa sits at his dining room table, surrounded by worksheets. It's time for one of his three weekly English lessons. And since it's December, today's is Christmas themed.
Decorations and ornaments?
Yes, decoration.
Ornaments?
Mm-hmm.
Go on the tree?
Yes.
Okay.
Ornaments?
That was close. Ornaments.
Vicky Linet, a volunteer with a Bucks County interfaith group, walks him through some vocabulary.
Okay.
What can the problem be if you eat too much food?
I have a stomachache.
Yes, good. Yes. You used our vocabulary word, stomachache.
Yes.
Very good. Okay.
The family's two-bedroom apartment is in a sprawling beige complex in Morrisville. Inside, it's cozy, but sparse. Computer paper printouts of phrases like home sweet home in Arabic hang on the walls. Mustafa's wife, Amal, has set out fruit and cakes for visitors. Stickers with the English words for everyday objects like door and fridge dot the apartment. They signal the steep learning curve the family has faced over the past year. Mustafa says he couldn't speak English at all when he started his cashier job at 7-Eleven. The first phrase he learned was, I have.
Second word, change. How much, how many... You need a bag? No? Okay, thank you. Yeah, like this. I don't know English. It's funny. Yeah.
He laughs, but the task is daunting.
It's really tough.
Bob Anderson coordinates volunteers for Team Mustafa and Amal on behalf of the Bucks County Interfaith Coalition for Refugee Resettlement. Government help for refugees lasts only about 3 months, so the volunteer group provides support to the family, including those English lessons, nearly every day.
It's tough to be poor in this country, or then to come in from another culture where you've been through trauma, violence, and then just have to pick up and make it work.
Mustafa and Amal have already overcome a lot, although you wouldn't know it by looking at them. They're both in their early 20s. His mustache barely shades his upper lip, and she looks girlish in a leopard print headscarf and matching long sleeve dress. Amal has a tendency to smile even when talking about painful events like the Syrian Civil War. The war separated her from her family, and now the U.S. travel ban means they can't visit her here.
I have 5 sisters. They are refugees. And I have a sister in Jordan, I have a sister in Lebanon, I have a sister in Turkey, and my sister in Aleppo.
The couple left Aleppo after several of Mustafa's family members got caught in the crosshairs of the war. One night, his dad was on their balcony when a stray bullet from the street struck him in the stomach. Now, here in Pennsylvania, fears over their safety have been replaced by a new anxiety— how to pay the bills.
I look now for a new job because...
Mustafa switches to Arabic, saying everything here is more expensive. Work at 7-Eleven is good, but the wages are too low to support his family. But those concerns are built on a foundation of triumphs. Before moving to Bucks County, Amal had never driven a car and didn't speak English. Now she has her license and takes their 4-year-old Yusra to pre-K in Levittown.
Oh, today I am late.
A couple of minutes past 12:30, Yusra charges up the steps of the school and into her teacher's arms.
Hi! I'm back! How are you? I miss you.
In this moment, their family is right on track for the safe and prosperous future they want for their kids. Laura Benshoff, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.